The Coin Week podcast is sponsored by PCGS. PCGS celebrating 30 years as the premier grading service. Visit www.pcgs.com to learn more. This week on the Coin Week podcast, we talk to hobo nickel master engraver Ron Landis. Landis was a pioneer of the new school of carving, which has not only reinvigorated the classic American folk art, but broadened the scope and appeal of it internationally. We'll see what Ron has to say next on the Coin Week podcast. Hi, Ron. Thanks for joining me on the Coin Week podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
I've always been interested in the folk art aspect of hobo nickels. But to collectors out there who may not be familiar with the craft or its history, what is a hobo nickel?
Well, a hobo nickel is an altered nickel, usually a buffalo nickel, the traditional format. And back probably about as early as 1913, when the coin was first released, people would start altering usually the Indian head, and they would change it into like a hobo with a beard and a hat, and they were novelty items, I would guess, and it caught on, and several people were carving them for many years and actually never stopped carving them. It's kind of been a resurgence lately, but
And the myth that has developed around them is that they were a form of alternative currency created by transients.
The folklore behind it is that hobos used to do this, and they trade it for meals and train rides and things like that. I think a lot of them were probably done by just engravers with some little extra time, or kind of like it is today. There's just hobbyists getting into it because it's a fun thing to do. I don't know if everybody that carved them were card-carrying hobos, but it certainly adds to the folklore. I use a lot of hobo themes in my carvings, but generally that's what that is. Now today, hobo nickels, the term hobo nickels kind of refers to just any carved coin, because the artists today are using coins from all over the world, modern coins, old coins, but generally still the traditional format is the buffalo nickel.
What was it about that coin that made it such a canvas for this kind of folk art?
Well, it's a soft metal. It's a copper-based alloy. It's 75% copper and 25% nickel. And so it's a pretty soft to carve. It's got a large head on it, which is conducive to altering into different faces. And it's also a fairly thick coin. So you got room to carve there. I don't know who did the first one, but it probably caught on, and it was just such a different thing. I can imagine that. I kind of think it was sort of a gag. Hobo art was kind of a fun thing to do back then. There was a lot of postcards and these hobos in cartoons and things like that. So I would think that there'd be like a gag behind it. Like you have one of these, you'd probably buy it for a couple of dollars maybe, and you'd show it to your buddy and say, hey, look, it looks like they had hired a hobo down at the mint or something. And, you get a yuck out of it or whatever. It's just, I think that's kind of how it started. It's just a sort of a novelty thing, and it was just a fun thing. People started doing things with the reverse now. Now they're carving the buffalo into a donkey or an elephant or some other animal, or a hiking hobo. They'll turn on its side and they'll turn some more risque subjects too. They'll have a hobo sitting on a toilet maybe, or this kind of thing. I think it just sort of developed. But the original folk art, they consider the originals being carved from the period of about 1913 to about 1980 when there was a hobo that carved coins. His name was George Washington Hughes, and he goes by the name of Bo. And it considered when he died, it was sort of the end of the original era. But people were still carving coins all the way up until when I started picking it up. But the art had pretty much degraded down to, well, there was a couple of people just doing very crude work with punches. So it's a very distinctive style, but not as artistic as like Bo would carve or some of these other. You can see some pretty talented work in some of these early carvings, and you can see the use of professional jewelry engraving tools, liner gravers, you know, that would engrave a series of parallel lines. These are professional engraving tools, which tells me that a lot of these guys had probably a little more skill than just, you know, a hobo carrying a sharpened screwdriver or something.
And what art style do you see predominantly?
Of course, you see all kinds of art in between, from a very crude knife carvings, which probably were done by hobos or just somebody just messing around with a knife and wheeling, from very amateurish work to very professional looking work. And some of these guys did a lot of work. We see the same style over and over. Like there was an engraver out there that had a certain style hobo that he would carve into it, and he'd do it over and over. Well, we can identify these guys if we can get three matching coins that are distinctly, you know, it looks like they're done by the same artist. It's like a fingerprint. And so part of what we do at the original Hobo Nickel Society is we'll compare notes, find coins that look similar, so we can identify some of these early carvers. And since they didn't sign their work, we give them names. And it's usually something that's descriptive of their style, like if there's a flat nose and a peanut ear, and we name these after the style of the carving that's on there. And I don't know how many they've identified now and given nicknames to, but there's a lot of them. This is a pretty popular folk art at one time. And like I said, it kind of died off until I started picking it up. I started carving in 1993, and I was the only one doing high-quality carvings at that time. There was a few other people doing kind of crude work with punches, and the market was set at $5. You would order from a style chart and say, well, I want a style number, you know, 23. And there'd be maybe 40 styles, you know, of different subjects that they would carve in them. And the market was $5. So when I first started doing this, I quickly discovered that, boy, there's no market in it. I can't compete with this. I can't engrave these for $5. So I kind of put it aside until I went to the American Numismatic Association summer seminar and listened to Bill Fiva's talk on hobo nickels. And he was showing slides of some really nice carvings. And it just piqued my interest again, and I thought, wow, this looks like a lot of fun. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to forget about the $5 market, and I'm just going to do what I want to do with them and see what happens. So I found a few buyers, and the people that were supporting my work and buying pretty much whatever I put out. Never had any problems selling them. I carve a batch of them. At that time, I was I was just trying to do kind of quick carvings, but trying to do them, you know, kind of a high relief, nice detail. But I wasn't trying to spend weeks on them. I do now. I spend several weeks to even months on a single carving now, because the market has changed. With a better market, engravers put more time into them, and today we're seeing some really outstanding artwork coming from engravers from all over the world. It's amazing the way it's taken off. And it's really market driven. I think when people started finding out the kind of prices my early carvings were bringing in auctions, it started attracting some really well-known firearms engravers, jewelry engravers, other die engravers, and just people that just starting. It's just they wanted to learn engraving so they could do these nickels. There's a lot of people that just started from scratch so they could do these. So it's done a lot for the art. I mean, like I said, when I first started carving, I was the only one for about 3 years doing high quality carving with real engraving tools. And now there are, geez, I don't know. I can't count them. I can't keep track. It seems like every week there's three or four new carvers coming onto the scene doing some amazing stuff.
Now, when you started carving hobo nickels, the idea that modern carvers would be making hobo nickels was seen by the collecting community as a little bit outrageous. Can you explain why there was a controversy surrounding modern carving?
Well, it was different. And I think people, it was just a different attitude. I think there seemed to be a sort of a mindset this was somehow destroy the history or I don't know. I think people just didn't quite understand it. I think that the fear was that it would upset the market. They couldn't tell if you copied an older style, that it would somehow mess up the market. That like, how would you tell a new carving from an old carving? My response to that has always been, it doesn't matter. If it's a good carving, there's an artist that spent a lot of time on that. The cream will always rise to the top. And a good carving, a lot of collectors now, I think, have changed their mindset about that. I mean, there's people that are very set on just collecting the originals, and I guess that could cause a problem for them if they can't tell the difference. But most artists carve put their initials into it and sign their work, and they're not trying to deceive anybody. I think that's where the fear was, because when the first book started coming out on hobo nickels, there were people that were copying the old ones and not signing their name, and it was confusing. But it's really, their work is really easy to identify. Again, they had a distinct style, like Frank Brazel was doing a number of carvings, and he was a real engraver. He used real engraving tools, and again, he sold them for $5 a piece. I understand he made about $4,000 a year. And there was another guy, I believe it was John DeRusa, was another one that started kind of copying some of the older carvings, and he would even sign Bo's initials on him. And now that's wrong. So I think he kind of messed it up and gave modern carvers a bad name, because he was trying to copy and sell them as old ones. He didn't need to. His work could stand on his own. He should have been putting, and eventually he was talked into doing that. His later carvings, he signed them. But there was that kind of a fear that it would mess up the market. But really, I mean, modern carvings really kind of go on par with older ones, it's all about quality. And I appeal. Of course, if you have a signed piece from a known original carver, like a bow or something, these can bring a lot of money. And I don't think there's a whole lot of trouble with people trying to copy his work. Again, you can kind of tell. People that look at these enough, they can tell if it's a real bow, just by the way it's finished, the patina on it. And older ones have a certain patina that you just can't copy that. So it's never really caused a problem. I tried to change the way. When I first started doing that, I got into a few people didn't care for what I was doing. They thought I was marring history and so forth. I was signing them, dating them, numbering them. I didn't want to cause a problem in the hobby. I just wanted to sell this art, and it's been a great thing for the hobby, I think. Now we have, with all these carvers coming in, we have new collectors too. And I think it's, Hobo Nickels can be a nice gateway into more serious coin collecting. You gain an appreciation for the art, of engraving, and that's a good foundation for getting into, you know, other aspects of numismatics. I know a lot of people that weren't coin collectors before, but they got in through the Hobo Nickel aspect of it. So I think it's a good thing for the hobby overall.
Do you have any favorite designs that you've executed?
Well, I like to keep it. I'm a musician as well. In fact, that's kind of my main thing now. But I like to use musical themes in my work, and I do, I try to keep kind of like a hobo theme in it. I like to do like hobo jungle scenes with hobos playing instruments or hitchhiking with an instrument or something like that. And I used to do that kind of stuff. So it's like they tell writers, they say, write what you know. And I think it's the same for artists. You should paint what you know, carve what you know, design what you know. And that's, if you do what you love, it's going to show in the work. And so that's why I don't carve a lot unless I get inspired and I really want to do something. I don't produce just to be putting out carvings. I kind of got to get inspired, and if I get a good idea, I get excited about it, and I want to do it. And it shows in the work, I think.
We did a cool coins video segment at the Fun Show earlier this year at the original Hobo Nickel Society booth, and I believe that they had one of your pieces on an American Silver Eagle. Do you remember this piece?
I did three of those. They're all different, but they're kind of similar, as they were all donated for different organizations. One was donated, to the original Hobo Nickel Society, and I believe that was the one that was on display. And I also did one for the American Numismatic Association. And I did one for the Brit Iowa Museum, Hobo Museum. And I did them all the same year, and they all had kind of a similar theme, a hobo theme to them. And they were donated as fundraisers for all those organizations. And, they were some of my better carvings from that period. Those were some of my early ones, and I did them on big, Silver Eagles, and yeah.
Was that an easy canvas to work with?
Well, it's big, and silver is really soft. That's, you would think that's a good thing, but it's really not. You want a kind of crisper metal. I prefer steel for carving because the softer the metal is, it can get squirrely. It doesn't cut real crisp. It can mush out, and so it's kind of, it's tricky to work with. It's hard with big areas. It's hard to get a good, smooth field. When I do a carving, I like the field to look like the coin was struck like that. So I don't just fill it out with texture or something. I really get in there and try to level that thing out and that's difficult to do from the positive. It's, especially if you're going around letters or something. Sometimes I change the lettering, so you have to carve the whole field down smooth and then carve the field around the new lettering so it all looks like it's on the same plane, so it looks like the coin was struck like that. It's more difficult. That's the little things that you don't see is sometimes the hardest to accomplish, like changing lettering like that. If you think about it, it's really hard to do. That's why they pay me the big bucks.
I saw that coin dealer John Kralovich had another piece that was attributed to you, which, getting to what you were saying about doing designs that look as struck, this was a really nice piece with a great basin out of which popped out a high relief effigy of George Washington.
Yeah, and that's a really early carving too. And yeah, thank you. I did. And that was a period I was doing that. I was doing high relief carvings. I think I did a Lincoln as well. I did several presidents actually. But that's what I like to do, is get a feel. And for a while I was experimenting around with, I would carve, and that may be one of those, where was the field actually polished like a proof? That may not have been, but I was doing that. I would get in there and I would polish the field, which is tricky to do because it's hard to polish up into the little crevices right next to the portrait. But I did that for a while, and then and then I would brush over or mask off and sandblast the portrait to make it look like a proof coin. And I did this for I don't know, I did several of them like that. And then I finally decided that that's going overboard. This is like a folk art. And to turn it into a proof is kind of like gilding a lily or something. And I kind of lost favor in doing those for what? It's a lot of hard work. But I really like the look of a matte finish coin. Even in regular coins, I like uncirculated coins more than proofs.
Well, speaking of gilding lilies, have you ever applied your craft to gold coins?
I have. Yes, one of my first ones was a Kruger hand. I did it for a local collector here. And where it said South Africa, I changed it to South Eureka Springs and changed, I don't know, I carved it into a hobo. Probably not one of my better carvings, but, and I also did a double portrait with my mother and father for their 50th anniversary and made a nice case for it, and she still got that.
So with the individual nature of this type of art and the fact that these are not mass produced by some state mint with real regulatory power, have you ever encountered or heard of collectors encountering false Landis pieces out there?
Oh, I've seen them. I mean, I've seen people copy my compositions before, but nobody has, not that I know of, that have successfully copied one of mine, tried to sell it as mine. I saw a couple on eBay. They were definitely copies of my compositions, but they weren't selling it as mine. Have you heard of anything like that?
No, I haven't heard of any pieces specifically being falsely or mistakenly attributed as your work. I just think that the potential exists based on the mechanics of the art form itself and the profit motive that exists in the marketplace.
My earlier ones, though, probably could be copied, but again, there's a kind of a fingerprint to them. Like I look at them, and I don't know, I can see my style in there. I think people that look at them a lot, I think they got a pretty sharp eye on that stuff. It's just like discovering any fake. You know, you see ancient coins faked, and there's something not right about it. You can't put your finger on it. And probably more so with carvings, I would think, because it is a personal, more of a personal style.
Are there any contemporary designers that you really admire their work?
Oh, Hobo Nichols? There's quite a few of them. Alesky Sabarov is probably the most amazing guy. He's just doing some really artistic work and mixing metals. He comes from a jewelry background. He's doing all kinds of stuff. He's done dye work. He does knives. I don't know if he does firearms or not. I'm sure he could. Jewelry engraving. He's an amazing artist. And there's a couple of Russian engravers that are doing some pretty amazing work. There's also, I like Paolo Caruso. He's a carver in Barcelona. And there's a few carvers in Spain. There's I believe Sean Hughes is doing kind of a love token kind of a thing. He's in Great Britain. There's a lot of guys doing it. Keith Peterson does some really kind of classic style stuff that I like. And there's some cruder things that I really like. There's a guy, J.D. Sherum, and he does kind of crude looking stuff, but it's very fantasy oriented. And the scenes that he puts into them are just really cute. And I don't know, I get a kick out of his stuff, but it's not, you know, it's probably more like pure folk art kind of a thing, where some of these guys are doing amazing medallic sculpture on these things. And so you see the whole spectrum of different styles with the hundreds of artists that are out there. I'm sure that, I mean, there's a lot of people I didn't mention that it's fun to see this blossom like this, because you know, for many years I tried to start a museum and, you know, just preserve the numismatic arts. And I was the one who wanted to put in apprenticeship programs and teach people how to do die sinking and this kind of thing. And that didn't really work out, but by accident, I sort of reignited an art form that kind of turned it into a whole different thing. It's amazing the way this thing has grown in the last 10 years. It blows me away. I'm just, you know, I was so used to kind of being, you know, I was the one that started, and I did pretty real good work, and I was getting great option prices. Now I'm just another guy in the crowd. Now there's some amazing artists out there doing really nice stuff. It's pretty neat the way it's all come together.
So what's your opinion of the actual original design of the Buffalo Nickel?
You mean the Fraser's design? Oh, it's a beautiful piece of numismatic art. It's one of the best U.S. coin designs we've ever had. I really love that coin. All those coins of the period, you know, the Mercury Dime and Walking Liberty Half Dollar, these are the things that got me interested in coins to begin with. They're beautiful, inspirational designs. When I was a kid, I used to stare at these things and put myself in that little world, you know. I don't know. It's unfortunately, we can't have those types of designs circulating again. It's, you know, after the presidential takeover of coin design, it's gotten pretty stagnant, and unfortunately it's going to stay that way because there's no politician that wants to touch those issues. They're hot button issues that nobody wants to be the one that suggests taking Jefferson off the nickel or taking Washington off the quarter, even though he was very opposed to putting presidents on coins. It's become a sacred cow, I think, to suggest taking these presidents off might be considered disrespectful. So that's why, I think we're stuck with these designs.
Let me put you on the spot and throw a couple coins at you, and you give me your Rorschach test answer as to what could be done with the coin to hobify it. What would you do with the Baseball Hall of Fame dollar?
Oh, gosh. What would you do? That's a, well, you know what I'd do on that? Is I'd make a high relief portrait out of it. And I've done this before, sort of like a, what do you call them? Pop-outs. Like a pop-out coin, that kind of relief.
What about the Richard Nixon presidential dollar?
Yeah. I'd probably make some sort of a satirical token out of it. I probably wouldn't change his portrait. I'd just put change of lettering on it and make it sort of a satirical piece, maybe.
Okay, Ron, last one. What about the 2009 ultra high relief gold coin?
Oh, yeah. I have an idea for that one. I want to put an ultra high relief portrait of St. Gaudens on that. And it would have to be done by adding a piece of gold in it. I try to keep the rest of it, the lettering kind of in there. In fact, I've had that planned for ever since coin came out, but I'm not sure if I can even do it. It's a lot of technical problems in that inlaying soft metal into soft metal like that. But I think it'd be a great tribute to St. Gaudens.
Okay, thanks, Ron, for joining us this week on the Coin Week podcast. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends. And remember, you can download each of our episodes off of the iTunes Store for free. For Coin Week, I'm Coin Week editor Charles Morgan. Until next time, happy collecting.